Welcome to the Number 10 Podcast. Hello and welcome to the Number 10 Podcast. I thought we'd do something fun this week. I want to look at the worst starts to a Prime Minister's career of all time. Two reasons for this. One, Boris Johnson has had a pretty bad start. I wanted to see who had it worst. Second, of course, we have the general election coming up in, I think 12 days from today when I'm recording, and I wanted to give some relevant content for that as well. So who had the worst start to a premiership in British history? Well, that's very clear-cut. Crystal Palace lost all of their seven opening matches in the 2017-18 season, with 17 goals away and no goals for. Just kidding. It isn't clear-cut which Prime Minister had the worst start, but many are saying that Boris has had a pretty terrible start statistically, but has been flying in the opinion polls. We'll talk more about him later, but let's go through, in this week's episode, my list of the worst starts for great British Prime Ministers of all time. Now, to set the scene, this is about what they did, what they didn't do, and also what they inherited, limited to the first few months, and sometimes a little bit longer, of their premiership. First off, I'm going to disqualify one Prime Minister who has been in the news recently, that of George Canning. He is the shortest-serving Prime Minister, if you total all the days in office, and he died of pneumonia in 1827, with the last words of Spain and Portugal. We're not going to talk about him because he probably had the worst start of any term, being that he died. Not necessarily his fault, and wouldn't be fair to burden him with that title that, if he had survived, could have been very different. More about him in about 100 years on the normal schedule. When Spencer Percival came to power in 1809, he was lucky that it lasted beyond the first few months. He was not elected Prime Minister, but replaced William Cavendish, who was forced to retire due to poor health. As was the case of many early Prime Ministers, monarchs were in charge of appointing cabinet members, meaning that Percival only had one cabinet member in the House of Commons on his side, which was Richard Ryder, who was the Home Secretary. As all the rest were in the Lords, Percival had to rely on his backbenchers to support him in debates in Parliament. In his first week, Percival lost four votes on the foreign and financial affairs. It was followed shortly by weeks of intrigue and then a public quarrel between George Canning, the then Foreign Secretary, and Lord Castlereagh, the colonial secretary, over conduct during the War of the Fifth Coalition, which was part of the Napoleonic War series. The details were about the failure of the Walcheren expedition, the year before when Canning had interfered with the selecting of the Earl of Chatham to command it, instead of Castlereagh's choice of Arthur Wellesley, later become Prime Minister himself as the Duke of Wellington. Canning and Castlereagh fought a duel on Putney Heath on the 21st September 1809, where Canning was injured in the thigh. Massive public outrage followed that two ministers resorted to such measures and reflected badly on Percival and the government. Both ministers were forced to resign and wouldn't return to office until Percival stopped being Prime Minister. Interestingly, four Prime Ministers have fought duels, two before they were Prime Ministers, William Petty and George Canning, and two whilst in the role, William Pitt the Younger and the Duke of Wellington. The last duel in the UK was in 1852. In early 1810, the government lost five more votes on the Walcheren expedition, and unusually for the time, the list of how MPs voted was published. These revealed how weak the government were, and led to a Whig leak of the details to a newspaper. You may have noticed that I said that Spencer Percival stopped being Prime Minister and not that he was voted out or resigned. This is because only 3 years into the post he would find himself on the receiving end of an assassin's bullet, holding the record for the only British Prime Minister to have been assassinated. Skipping forward a century, Canadian-born Bona Law took office in 1922 for the Conservative Party, having been in politics on and off since around 1900. Law's health wasn't great when he entered Number 10, which had been on the decline since losing his two eldest sons in the Great War. His poor health actually lost him the leadership of the party in 1921. But this time away wouldn't last long. Bona Law was decisive in toppling the much-loved David Lloyd George, where the Conservatives pulled their support to the Liberal coalition, and after a swift general election, the Conservatives won 382 of the 615 seats. The then King George V invited Bona Law to form a government. Interestingly, this was the first national election for the Labour Party, who immediately became the second party, pushing the Liberals into third place. Winston Churchill also found himself kicked out of office in the seat of Dundee that he'd represented since 1908, losing to the Labour politician E.D. Morrell. Apart from having an unfortunate name by today's standards, Bonar Law didn't have a great start. It started poorly with an elderly Conservative Treasurer, Lord Farquhar, refusing to pay the Conservatives' expenses for the 1922 election, and it transpiring that he had given vast sums raised by selling peerages to the Liberal former Prime Minister, David Lloyd George. There was a large matter of World War I debt repayments that also caused huge issues. The UK owed a huge amount of money to the US for money borrowed during the war, but was owed even more by France, Italy and other allied European countries. Due to the previous agreements under David Lloyd George, the UK couldn't collect any more money than what they were paying to the US, crippling trade and the economy throughout Law's premiership. Even worse, Law's Chancellor, the inexperienced Stanley Baldwin, agreed to repay $40 million per year to the US as opposed to the $25 million agreed with Cabinet on a trip to the USA. Before talking about the change with Bonar Law, he announced it as soon as he stepped off the ship in Southampton, further adding to the dreadful economic problems that the country was suffering. Law would only survive 2 years as Prime Minister after being diagnosed with throat cancer and was no longer able to physically speak in Parliament. Often referred to as the unknown Prime Minister, after Liberal politician H.H. Asquith remarked at the funeral that he should be buried next to the tomb of the unknown soldier in Westminster. The Viscount Goderich was installed as Prime Minister after the death of George Canning. He is currently the shortest serving Prime Minister who has not died in office, with 144 days served. If Boris Johnson loses the December election, he will take this title with 142 days served as Prime Minister. Canning, a Tory, had had difficult time balancing the demands of the Whigs and the Tories, which at the time, you still needed the support from both to get anything done. Again, like Percival, the King appointed ministers, so you were forced to work with your opposition. Despite King George IV being overtly favourable to the Tories, of which Goderich was one, his start to the Prime Ministership was not great. Coming into power in the 1820s, he inherited a chaotic parliament, which, as we said, Canning had failed to balance and control. The Whigs only had 3 seats in cabinet, and were forceful in demanding an extra position for Lord Holland as Foreign Secretary. The King saw this as unnecessary and refused to grant the additional place for the Whigs. The King himself had little respect for Goderich, calling him a damned snivelling, blubbering blockhead. One leading Whig at the time said of Goderich, "They think Goderich has behaved so ill in this affair that they have no confidence in him. They believe so much in the integrity of his character that they do not suspect him of any duplicity in what has passed. But his conduct has been marked by such deplorable weakness as shows how unfit he is for the situation he occupies." Canning had also been ghosted by prominent Tories, the Duke of Wellington and Robert Peel, both future Prime Ministers, and there was rumours that the King would bring Wellington in and replace Goderich. Without these great men who commanded so much of the Tory party's support, as well as a new faction in the Tory party opposing the Catholic Relief Act, known as the Ultra-Tories forming, Goderich was doomed to fail. Goderich was in ill health himself, with a sense of inadequacy and indecisiveness to boot. His wife also suffered from severe mental health issues, with one Tory stating, "Poor Goderich is quite unnerved and in a most pitiful state. Much of this misfortune is perhaps the natural effect of his character, but it is, in the present instance, greatly aggravated by the constant worry in which he has been kept by his all but crazy wife, and by the entire ascendancy with his good nature, not to say his weakness, has allowed her to assume." The King openly preferred Wellington, and planned by January at the latest that he should replace Goderich. Goderich had himself written a resignation letter, but hadn't sent it to the King. The King, in January, sent for Goderich, and in a meeting at Windsor, the outgoing Prime Minister was said to have had a handkerchief passed him by the King, as he was in tears. More humiliatingly, the King asked Goderich to personally arrange for his successor, the Duke of Wellington, to attend the King. Goderich is a great example of the stresses of the role of Prime Minister and a sad case of turmoil inflicted by the King, Whigs and his own party. The abolition of slavery and Catholic emancipation, as well as the hated and loved Corn Laws, made it a difficult time to bring people together, even though the Tories had a huge majority in the 1826 election. Goderich is the shortest serving Prime Minister who did not die in office. Some good news though, both Goderich and his wife began to recover their mental health issues after he left the premiership.
From number 10 Downing Street, the Prime Minister interviewed in Panorama. Good evening. We start tonight's programme by interviewing the Right Honourable Edward Heath, who came here to number 10 as Prime Minister nearly 16 months ago. The bloodshed and the terror in Ulster, the rising unemployment, the widening conflict of opinion about entry into the common market, those are some of the problems faced by Mr. Heath and the government as they prepare for their second full session of Parliament. Recent by-election results show a sharp drop in Conservative support. This week's Conservative Party conference in Brighton will be an opportunity for the Prime Minister and his colleagues to defend their record and explain their policies. But first, Prime Minister, may we talk about Ulster, that part of the United Kingdom which Mr. Faulkner said the other day was bleeding to death. Do you claim that government policy in Ulster is having much success?
I want first of all to say what our objective is in Ulster. What I want is to have Northern Ireland the opportunity for everybody there, whatever their religion or whatever their political view may be, have the same opportunities of life as we have in this country. Northern Ireland is just as much part of the United Kingdom as Scotland or Wales or Lancashire or Kent, and I want to see there exactly the same conditions and exactly the same opportunities. When you say about government policy, then it is twofold. First of all, there must be an arrangement as far as the machinery of government is concerned, which will achieve our objective, in other words, provide those conditions. And this means that, as we've said, Mr. Maudling said when he invited people to discuss this problem with him, that there must be a permanent and guaranteed part in the machinery of government in Ulster for all those who want to take part. And the second thing we must do is to get on top of the gunmen. Now, there are some who think that one is a substitute for the other, but this is not the case. There's no answer in just putting forward proposals for political solutions, because the gunmen themselves don't want a solution. They will do their utmost to prevent it. On the other hand, when we have got on top of the gunmen,
I'm sure there many must still of you are enjoying the new series of The Crown, like I am, in which we see Harold Wilson and then Edward Heath and their difficulties during the 1960s and the 1970s. Ted Heath was the MP for the constituency where I grew up, Old Bexley and Sidcup in South East London. Heath won an average-sized majority in 1970, but inherited the highest levels of unemployment since the 1950s. State-mandated power cuts, swingeing welfare cuts, and the imprisoning of striking dock workers led to a huge disapproval of Heath in the early years. One of the key things that many in the UK regularly bemoan and remember is that Heath's government under Margaret Thatcher as the Education Secretary stopped free school milk in the early years. A side point here is that many of the public didn't trust him as a single middle-aged man in Downing Street. A more old-fashioned time, it made people uncertain, with some questioning whether he might have been gay, which had only been legalised in the UK since 1967. Crippled by inflation, Heath's policies were tough measures attempting to reform the failing British economy, mostly from actions of Harold Wilson, the previous Prime Minister. An early blow was the death of Ian Macleod, Heath's Chancellor of the Exchequer, in July 1970, which some believe would have been helpful to the Conservative economic policy in the early days.
Berwick Street Market in central London. This 12-foot high pile is part of 2 weeks' rubbish just from the market. And this is the rest, piled outside the local refuse depot. Like others in central London, it's been closed now for 2 weeks because of the dustman's indefinite strike. Officially, there is no health hazard yet, but today health officers began spraying against insects, although the cold weather means little danger yet. They also laid down rat bait. not though on the many pavements which are already partly blocked, not only with the more hygienic plastic bags, but also with cardboard boxes dripping with food scraps and loose rubbish. To ease the health and fire dangers, squares as famous as Leicester Square have been transformed into special dumps. But while this sight may seem offensive enough, councils say these dumps should be much fuller. Too few individuals and firms, they say, are bothering to bring rubbish to dumps. Instead, they're taking the easy way out, opening their doors and leaving rubbish outside. To prevent real discomfort next week, say councils, that must change. Nick Gowing, ITN.
Thatcher, the milk snatcher, as she's known in some circles in the UK, stepped into number 10 after beating Ted Heath in a leadership election. Much of the early years were reminiscent of the years before she had become Prime Minister. The Conservative Party was packed with old white men who didn't believe a woman could do the job and was despised in the early years of her tenancy. She also inherited the premiership at a very unstable time. The winter of discontent had just been, and as much as it helped her to gain power by using effective advertising campaigns such as the famous Labour Isn't Working posters that saw the motto in large letters above a massive queue of people outside unemployment centres, it also meant she inherited massive union action through striking, which had, along with the bitterly cold winter of the year before, brought the country to its knees economically, with reduced retail, some jobs not being able to be completed at all, and just a general downturn in the economy. Many still supported Edward Heath and would disagree with her regularly, often referred to Thatcher as the Wets. By December 1980, her approval rating was at 23%, the lowest ever recorded than any other British Prime Minister. This probably wouldn't change until around about 1982 and the successes in the Falklands and when the economy began to recover. There were huge riots across the country in the early years, such as the 1981 Brixton riots over dreadful living conditions in the local African Caribbean communities in South London. Economic reform to close failing public industries such as the mines saw steel and coal production at its lowest since 1931, and unemployment was at its highest since 1934. Heath had suffered with worsening relations with Ireland, but it reached a boiling point during the early Thatcher years, with Airey Neave, a Tory MP and Thatcher ally, being blown up in the House of Commons car park just before the Iron Lady was elected. Thatcher and Heath were both very different characters, but suffered the same problem. They were isolated at the top from the very beginning. A mention should probably go out to David Lloyd George, who inherited the First World War and relied throughout his time on Conservatives and newspaper barons like Lord Northcliffe of the Times and the Daily Mail publications. Lloyd George had been in an ongoing feud with the last Prime Minister, Herbert Henry Asquith, usually shortened to H.H. Asquith. When Lloyd George committed the political coup d'etat on Asquith in 1915, the battle between them waged on for many more years, with a complex division in the party on detailed ideological differences in approach.
Mr. Speaker, the disastrous military events which have happened during the past fortnight have not come to me with any sense of surprise. Indeed, I indicated a fortnight ago, as clearly as I could to the House, that the worst possibilities were open. And I made it perfectly clear that whatever happened in France would make no difference to the resolve of Britain and the British Empire to fight on, if necessary for years, if necessary alone. I have thought it right upon this occasion to give the House and the country some indication of the solid practical grounds upon which we base our inflexible resolve to continue the war. There are a good many people who say, never mind, win or lose, sink or swim, better die than submit to tyranny, and such a tyranny. And I do not dissociate myself from them. But I can assure them that our professional advisers of the three services unitedly advise that we should carry on the war and that there are good and reasonable hopes of final victory. And so bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its Commonwealth last for 1,000 years, men will still say this.
So to a mention for Winston Churchill, who inherited a dreadfully unprepared military in 1940, Unpopular with many Tories and the elite British class, Germany invaded France on the day that he took over from the disgraced Neville Chamberlain. 2 weeks into the role, he faced almost certain loss of tens of thousands of soldiers from the British Expeditionary Forces at Dunkirk, but by some miracle and some plucky British fishermen assisting the Navy, as well as Tom Hardy and his Spitfire, most survived and were brought back to the UK. In 1940, the UK was only spending $3.5 billion on combat munitions compared to Germany's $6 billion. And what about Theresa May failing to make any progress on Brexit and then calling an election that lost her slim majority in 2017? After that, little was achieved. I wouldn't really put her on this list, only because she had a majority from the 2015 election and didn't have what I thought would have been an insurmountable task with the Brexit talks. Unfortunately, she isolated the hard right backbenches of her own party and had little support from other parties and became a woman on a boat in the middle of the lake without any oars and probably without any arms either. What about now? Boris Johnson has lost more important votes more rapidly than any other British Prime Minister. He's lost more MPs, mainly by 20 or so he kicked out, since Robert Peel split the Tories in 1852, costing the aged party around 40 MPs in the election. Boris has had a pretty decent track record when he was Mayor of London, which we spoke about a lot in last season with the Boris Jeremy Corbyn episode, so go back and listen to that if you haven't. Although his time as Prime Minister has seen him fail to get us out by October 31st, which was a steel-clad promise, granted, not all his fault, and went through a tricky time where he was ruled to have unlawfully prorogued Parliament and humiliatingly had to recall it. He's currently at around about 35% approval ratings with YouGov and 42% approval if we use the Delta poll across the next set of what I'm just about to say, which is up from 38% in July. The same study shows Corbyn with an approval rating of only 30% right now, and the same as what it was in February 2019. Take Corbyn back to 2017, his approval rating is as high as 46% through YouGov. All the polls are showing a Johnson victory of quite some margin, and as someone who has spent quite a lot of time learning about what polls to listen to, I think we're probably going to see that, as long as there's no massive surprises. Johnson's majority of voters are looking like a mixture of middle England and some in lower middle class and working class based on the Brexit stance. These groups of people are notoriously unmoving in their vote on the whole, and I can't see a massive shift in his core demographic. In 2 weeks, we have a general election. This is going to be the greatest test for Johnson and whether he'll have a chance to turn the tide on a pretty terrible start to a premiership. Though, when you look at a lot of the politicians above, many went on to have incredibly successful premierships. I'd love to hear your views on the above and whether you would have added any others to the list here. To mention again, we are running a competition at the moment. Courtesy of the great people at House Publishing, I've got 3 copies of a brilliant book by Jack Brown, who we had on last season to talk about No. 10 Downing Street as a building. No. 10, The Geography of Power at Downing Street, is a fantastic book that looks at modern-day prime ministers, the building, and a lot of new information about how British political power operates from within a small, unassuming building in central London. I've got 3 copies to give away, and one will have a £20 Amazon gift voucher inside just in time for Christmas. All you need to do is let us know who your favourite Prime Minister is and why. Email it over to chris@no10po.com or reply to our pinned tweet out on Twitter at No. 10 Podcast or on Facebook by searching No10Po. That's N-O-10-P-O. And that's all for this week. Have a great one and I'll see you soon. Goodbye.